This is side four of the tape of the taped interview with Arthur Jaffe.
You had mentioned some of the work with refugees. Before we proceed, would you like to tell us something about that?
Well, you know, as we went through Europe, refugees started to appear. They were let loose, they escaped, they had been in hiding, all kinds of situations.
Are you speaking of Jewish refugees?
Basically Jewish refugees. There were others, but the only ones that I came in contact with. And of course, when they heard there was a Jewish officer someplace, why, they gravitated to that area, and we gravitated looking. If there were services, they would appear at my services. Because I was doing these services, a lot of them would show up. And so we had, like, when we had a Seder, we would invite them. So the Seder was a mixture of soldiers and the refugees. And so I got to know some of the refugees that way, and we would try to help them get through the bureaucracy of, you know, everything was pretty chaotic, yet it wasn't all that well organized. See that they got to the JDC or whatever it was. So that was, you know, that was ways. When we did have the Seder, I got German prisoners of war to do the serving. And we explained to them what this was all about, so they would understand these were Jewish people, Jewish soldiers, American soldiers, and this was a Passover, and this was what this was all about, and you're serving them.
Yes. And you trusted them not to put poison
in
the food?
Well, I don't think they were in a position to do very much. They were pretty docile by that time. You know, not every soldier went. They were carpenters and tailors and barbers in the German army, just like any place else, and not all of them are the kind of picture that you get in the newsreels or the kind you see in the movies that everybody was a Heil Hitler. Maybe they weren't all. They really weren't. Just as all Americans
were
true blue either.
When you say the Jewish refugees, were these people that had roamed the country, had been in hiding, been in concentration camps?
Some had been in concentration camps, some had gotten away, some had been in hiding, some were released. Remember, nothing's ever 100%. And we weren't talking about having thousands of them. They were just
the small stragglers,
right.
Groups.
Right.
That probably had been protected by their
Some had been protected, some had, you know, just gotten in hiding in a variety of ways.
That must have been a rewarding experience because you really felt you could see the results.
Yeah, well, we
of what
felt
you
good
were
about
doing.
We went to Europe to beat Hitler and liberate him, and there it was.
And
it
you
did.
Did.
And we did it, you know.
All right. Now you came back and you went to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And through Hebrew University. To what direction? And where were you heading? What were you?
I wasn't heading anywhere, really. I was going just to...
Marking time.
Exactly. I was marking time. And...
What was Israel like at that time?
Palestine. It was a mandatory power. Remember, this is 1946. I don't think anybody at that point that I knew would have ever, if anybody had been a betting man, I don't think you could have gotten a bet that in 1948 there would have been a Jewish state. I'm not talking Americans like myself. I'm talking about people living there.
Yeah. Was life very difficult there at that time?
Well, you mean physically,
mm-hmm.
or
yes.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, where this
Always.
Was? Hebrew University was in Tel Aviv.
Jerusalem. Mount Scopus.
Should know that.
The original Hebrew University, not where it is now.
Not where it is now.
But Mount
right.
Scopus. Although I think they still have
a campus
there. Up there. Yeah. And there's a building there named for a Pittsburgher, the Rosenblum building, Charlie Rosenblum's
mm-hmm.
father.
At Mount Scopus?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. how did you live there? Did you live in dormitories? Why are you
smiling? That's a funny story. It's a very funny story. We came and we went by boat.
Are you talking about the eight? You all went together, the Americans went together. Okay.
On a boat.
Mm-hmm.
The Vulcania. It was an Italian luxury liner in a First World War vintage, which had been taken over by the Americans, and it wasn't very luxurious at this point. For several years after the Second World War, the transportation system in the world was really run by the Army. You just didn't get on a boat and go to Europe. The Army controlled it, at least for a year or so. It was still very highly controlled. And so we went to Palestine on a ship run by the Army, even though everybody's civilians now. These were all civilian people going back to the Middle East. And it cost, I think the trip was about 13 days. And it cost about $200.
Did you pay your own way?
Oh, we paid our own way, of course. Yeah, we paid our own way. We stopped off in Naples and Capri. Finally, we landed. You didn't go to Palestine. You landed in Egypt, Alexandria. This was no easy trip. I mean, this was not luxury. It was four of us living in a very cramped quarters and down below in the hold almost. So I went, there were two Americans and two very Orthodox older men in the same cabin with us, in bunks. Mm-hmm. And they were Orthodox and they wouldn't trust the food on us. They brought huge salamis, bigger than they could call each day. It wasn't air conditioned. And you'd go through that Mediterranean and cut that off every day. It was
not a pleasure cruise?
It was not a pleasure cruise. Although we had,
There was no port in Palestine that they used?
No. We went to Alexandria. We got off in Alexandria. We had to fight our way off. The Egyptian authorities were not happy having Jews, even though they were Americans. They took our passports. They mistreated the older people. We had fist fights, the American soldiers XGIs, with the authorities at the landing dock. They actually mistreated our older people. Were some old age people going back to Palestine finally that had been caught in the United States for all those years. So we took a train from Alexandria to Cairo, and then we went from Cairo on a First World War train that Allenby built across the desert from Cairo to Lydda, which is now called Lod, where the airport is. We got off the train there, got on another train going up the mountains to Jerusalem. And that train was so old, had so little power, that as it went up the mountain, at certain inclines, we all had to get off the train so it could make the grade, and then you walk by it, and then get back on again. When we got to Jerusalem, we were very important people to the university because Israel or Palestine, the Yeshua of the settlement, the Jewish settlement, saw us as the forerunner of some vast migration from the United States. And we were very special to the Hebrew University. So there were only three of us who made that trip up to Jerusalem at that particular point. The other five students who came with us had friends and other associations. They left and went other directions. But we were greeted. Because I didn't know where to go. I had no friends. I had no place to go. And the other two didn't either. And we were greeted by an official from the Hebrew University by the name of Poznansky, who was like third in command of the Hebrew University at the time. And he met us at the train station. And it was just a few days before Passover. Pesach was very early that year. And he said, We have no dormitories. Hebrew University doesn't have them. And he says, we don't even have a place for you to live yet, permanently. He said, however, we have families who have agreed to take you until we're able to find you housing. And he said, we have the families divided into three groups, and you have your choice: kosher, not so kosher, and others. So the three of us took others, and I was assigned to live with Dr. and Mrs. Yaski. Dr. Yaski was the medical director of Hadassah Hospital, later assassinated on his way to the hospital in an ambush with his wife with him. She escaped. Dov Peleg, that's his name now, who's still there, was assigned to live with Dov Josephs, who later became the first minister of interior of Israel and was military governor during the siege of Jerusalem in 1948. Also, his wife had family in Pittsburgh. And the third, Ben Gale, was assigned to live with a fellow by the name of Abadi, family by the name of Abadi. Abadi was brother-in-law to Dov Josephs. Abadi was the official translator for the mandatory power. One of the reasons that we were assigned to these three families, but they all spoke some English, some of them spoke very well, some of them spoke perfectly. They all spoke English well, let's put it that way. They all lived nearby one another so that we three Americans could keep in touch with one another. And they all had space for us. They all were people of means by Israeli standards, Palestinian standards at that time. That's where we went.
What were those names again?
I lived with the Yaskis.
Yaskys. And the other is Josephs?
Dov Josephs, who became the first minister of interior, first cabinet, then the military governor of Jerusalem, and Abadi, who was the official translator for the mandatory power. British were in control, remember, it was British.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of a name is it, Bob?
Syrian. Sephardic name.
Abadi?
Abadiya, or something like Abadi. As a matter of fact, it was his family that was in Pittsburgh. Mrs. Douglas was an Abadi. They had a linen place on Fifth Avenue, linen importers.
What did you study while you were there that year?
Well, not a whole lot, something. Did study a little bit. I didn't know much Hebrew, not speaking Hebrew. Liturgical Hebrew is one thing to read it.
Well, but you said you went to New York for 6 weeks.
Oh, that was to learn how do you order coffee in a restaurant.
Oh, I see.
How much you learn in 6 weeks. There was no ulpans in Israel.
No ulpans, right.
There were no ulpans. It's long. There was no state. You have to go back and think that way. And when we arrived in Lod Lidov, the railroad station, the three of us, and I heard a little boy at the railroad station talking to his dog in Hebrew. The dog understood.
That is.
So I said to the other two,
dog.
I said, yeah, we should be able to learn this.
It's a difficult language.
So they did assign a student to teach us Hebrew. One of the students.
Their classes were then held in Hebrew.
Yes, their classes were held in
Hebrew.
Then
you had to learn.
Mm-hmm. And so we spent a lot of time doing that.
How long were
Let
you
me show you something very interesting. When I moved to Pittsburgh from Butler, I thought that I was a widower, that emptied out the house by myself. And I thought that I had gotten everything out of the house. About 3 years or so after I left Butler, I got a call one day from a woman who said, are you the Arthur Jaffe who lived at 113 Glenwood Way? I said, yes. She said, well, I'm living here now. I'd sold the house to somebody else. And three other people, three, this, she was the third person to have lived in this house since I had sold it. And she said, well, we love the house. We you built it, yes. She said, well, I wish we could buy it, but my husband is in charge of the Army recruiting in this part of Western Pennsylvania. We're only here for 3 years or whatever. She said, what I'm calling about is, she said, I found a suitcase. And then we had, it was a ranch house, and it had one of those.
Pull down.
And I had apparently stuffed a suitcase up there. We ran out of space. She pulled down a suitcase, and in that suitcase, she found my high school diploma, my love letters to Lois and myself, okay, and a lot of things. And she said, I was going to throw it out, but then I found out where you lived, and she said, do you want it? I said, yes, I want it now, so I'll pick it. I had somebody pick it up. When I got it, I had found things in there I'd forgotten all about, totally. I didn't even miss the bag, so you can tell how bad, you know. And in there, I found a little diary that I kept in 1946 and 47 when I lived in Palestine. And this is relating to what you and we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And in here, because we were special and because you had, what did we study? The Yeshua of the settlement, the people who ran, the Jews who ran the Jewish community, saw us as somebody special, and they wanted to make sure that we were taken care of and understood what was going on, and which was very, we did not know, we knew very little about what was going on. The world didn't know very much about what was going on. And so they assigned us a person to give us an orientation series of lectures over 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 week period. We would meet each week at a person's home, and the same person would come in and lecture to us. The 3, 4, 5, 6 of us who were there, that was about it. Okay, about 5 or 6 of us get together each week, and this person would then tell us about the history of the development of Palestine and so forth in the Jewish community. And the person's name is Golda Meyerson. Now, Golda Meyerson didn't mean much. Now, this is like February 13th, 1947. It was 5 o'clock. So, yeah, it's me. Because you don't eat dinner late, do you? That was European style. In Israel, you don't eat until 8 o'clock at night or not. You know, 5 o'clock's just middle of the afternoon, you know. Then you go back the next week and you see Golda Meyerson again. I'd forgotten all about this book. Magnus is president of the Hebrew University. Levin Epstein.
Brings back a lot of memories.
Mm-hmm. Nurses dance.
Interesting. I'm looking over your shoulder. This is written in English, but this looks like it's written in Hebrew.
It is.
Is that how you study? Is that
how
you learn it?
No, start mixing things up, right.
You certainly had marvelous lectures.
Yeah. Right here, Midland's marriage, I'm sick. I wasn't sick about the marriage. I was sick. I must have been sick.
You were sick, sick, sick.
Sick, sick, sick.
Did you ever have any urge to live there, to stay there?
I went back in 1959 with the idea, just on my own, after I was married at this point, just to scout around thinking that we might move. But I never did.
When you were there on this trip, were you there? Let's see, the partition was in 47, was it?
48.
48. You were not there then?
No, I was back by that time. I was recruiting for the Hakanah.
You
recruited Al Twersky. You know Al? In Pittsburgh.
Rabbi Twersky?
No.
Al Twersky.
No, I thought you might know Al. Uh-huh. Edie Twersky,
mm-hmm.
Edie's husband, lost a foot there. You know Edie. She does all that
fabulous
desserts
fabulous
for the restaurants, and he works for Benkovitz. You know, that's how I met him, recruiting him.
Did you? Were
19
you,
years old.
Did they, in other words, when you were in Israel, mm-hmm. they made you very aware of the Haganah?
Oh, yeah, well, we didn't even get to that part, did we?
No.
No.
You, like, you took a flying leap. Let's back up.
Let's back up to that.
Well, technically, legally, I was still in the American Army, even though I was discharged. I was legally in the reserves. There was still a lot of military feeling around, and I was in the reserves, and I was never released until many, many, many years later from the reserves. Even though I was not active, I was never released. I was required by law at that time to register when I got to Palestine with the military attaché, the American military attaché. So I did.
They had one, and they had the attaché in Palestine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, remember there was a diplomatic relationship between the mandatory power and the United States. This wasn't a Jewish state, and of course they all knew all the Jewish people there, and the Hebrew University students. Most of them were young people like ourselves, younger. Younger, you know, we were all old men. I was already 23, 24. We had already been through a war and so forth. When you think of how young we were and what kind of responsibility we had, it's hard to think of it. It's a good thing I didn't know how young I was.
Older people couldn't have done it.
Yeah. And they were all in the Haganah. And Sunday, one day, somebody came to me, along with some of the others, Americans, and asked us if we would be willing to join the Haganah. And being young, single, and caught up in what was going on there, you don't say no.
So you did join the Haganah?
Yeah, officially. We had sworn in and everything else, like a regular army.
But that was considered all right with your American citizenship? There was no conflict?
Well, you know, if I commit a murder, unless I'm charged with it, nothing happens. While the American government, I'm sure, knew what was going on. They didn't do anything about it. If you don't do anything about it, it wasn't really all that illegal. First of all, I hadn't joined a foreign government because there was no government. One. Two, I wasn't voting in any foreign election because there was nothing to vote for. So, I don't know how illegal all we did was, if it was illegal. It may not have been something some of the State Department would be happy about, but there wasn't a whole lot they could do about it. Or maybe they didn't want to do anything about it. No, if they wanted to, I'm sure we could have made life miserable.
What
for us.
Was the,
the British
purpose
weren't happy.
Of the Haganah? What was the about?
Well,
Haganah was really
the defense organization for the Jewish settlement. Now, there was no official one because there was no official army. And, you know, there were two other groups. There was the Irgun, and there was the Stern Gang. And we had American students in both of those groups. Not all Americans agreed on the way it should be done. Friends of mine who went over with us, or who came later, were members of the Irgun and members of the Stern Gang. Some of them were back in the United States. Travel agents, such harmless things as that. That's what happens to old soldiers.
Did you stay there just for the year?
No, I was there 46 and 47. I came back late 47, like October, November.
Why did 47. You come back?
Well, when I went over, I said, I'll be back. That was the first thing. I just said to my dad, I'm gone, I'll be back.
Were you inspired by the country or what
oh,
they
yes.
were doing?
Oh, yes. Of course. Of course. I mean, it was, how would you like to be here when George Washington was here? You know.
He was pioneering.
Sure. I mean, there was a feeling that even Israel has never experienced again. I mean, it was a time when there of egalitarianism, the spirit of the kibbutz dominated the country. A cooperative effort, and everybody did their bit, and people weren't, there weren't, well, they were rich and they were poor. Being rich was not something to be especially even proud of there, you know, at the time. It was a, it was a idealistic society that they were, this, you know, society, we're going to build this great society in which everybody is equal and...
Oh, when you say they were rich.
And, oh, they were rich Jews.
They were rich Jews. Of Cyprus, people born there, or
sure.
they were Orientals,
no.
or...
Well, you know, people like people who owned the chocolate factories were the rich, the Lieber people, the elite fabric, and people at the fab factory, and the people who were in textiles. Yeah, it was, you know, I had a friend of mine whose family owned Cyprus, who owned the big office supply equipment companies there, you know, like McCloy's in Pittsburgh, that type of, you know, typewriters and...
Funny you should mention that.
Yeah.
We'll take that advisedly.
That type of awe, they had stores in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and Haifa.
Oh. What was general housing like at that time?
Well,
your average.
The small. The few places where I stayed, they were rich people by the standards of that society, the Yaskis, and they weren't millionaires, but they were considered rich.
Comfortable.
They had a car, and they had a home, and they had more than one bedroom, and you know, those kinds of things. Places were small. I had some family there, cousins of my father's that I later met, and they didn't, you know, they had Coleman stoves. You cooked. You didn't have electric ranges. You didn't have electric refrigerators. It was ice. When we lived in Jerusalem, there was ration of water, and we were only allowed to take a shower so many times a week.
When you lived in Jerusalem, were you in the old city, or were you in the environs?
I lived in a place called Montefiore Chadasha, New Montefiore.
What's that?
That was out near where the, today, not far from where the Egged barnyards are. The bus system has their yards there. That was way out.
In other words, that's not where the Montefiore steps are now.
No.
But then you really were in the, you were...
Wait, the old city was in the city.
Behind the
old city, yeah. And the Hadassah Hospital and the Hebrew University was on the exact opposite side of the city and out of the city on top of Mount Scopus. It was totally different.
How'd you get back and forth?
Bus. Heck of number 9. 7, it takes 7 and 9.
Was our time?
We're fine.
Shall we proceed?
Because
I don't want to. Is there anything else from that time that you feel significant before we come back?
I don't know.
To the United States. Well, that you.
Oh, well. You
I mean,
know,
is there
I
anything especially that you'd like to tell us about your experiences there before returning to the United States?
Well, you know, we were very active in the Haganah. Had a lot of training.
What kind of training?
Well, I had to be retrained, as a matter of fact. While I'd been an infantry officer, I was used to American weapons. I knew how to take apart a rifle, an M1, blindfolded, put it back together again. Now, the rifles I had in the Israelis had were Czechoslovakian rifles. I didn't know how to take a Czechoslovakian rifle apart and put it back together. I didn't know how to shout. The capabilities of that particular kind of a rifle. I didn't know how to shoot it. So I went through basic training.
Was this done overtly or covertly?
Covertly. We would meet in casually in small groups of 3 or 4 in somebody's home, ostensibly for social purposes. But there were guns hidden in walls and secret places. They'd bring them out, and we'd go to a private room, one of the people would be an instructor and say, we get a table like this, there'd be 3 of us sitting around, and say, now, take the rifle apart, this is where you take it apart, these are the parts, and now we put it back together again, pieces of wood, or you put it back together again. And then later on, we went out to how to shoot it.
The British were all around, though, were they not?
Yes, they would stop us and try to search us, but they didn't bother. When they'd see the American passport, they were careful. But the Israelis, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you always worried with the worst. Did they know why we were going there, why what we were doing there? They probably did, but they never.
I think you're probably the only interviewee that we have that has had this experience, and I'm sure that it would be, you know, anything about it that you can tell us would be something that we.
Well, I had to learn a lot of other
else.
Things. For example, my training was that we would learn how to maneuver with. We would have support of tanks and airplanes.
Arthur, I hate to stop you, but we're at the end of this tape, and I don't want it to get lost.
Anyway.
Okay.
Well, that's why I wanted to get to the end of this.